The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In.
You have always been a voice of reason through all of this.
Appreciate your time, what you're doing for America.
I give you advice. And doesn't work at all.
You are definitely not inept by any means.
I like to hear women say that about me.
Whatever advice you're going to send my way, I am 100% taking it.
I can't tell you what to do. I will not tell you what to do.
Okay. Well, thanks.
That wasn't the answer I wanted.
Are you kidding me?
Great stuff, Dr. Ray. I'm glad I called.
I've scheduled my day around listening to your radio show.
You don't have to laugh so hard.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
I can give you a promise. I commit to you there will be no New Age stuff on this program. Mostly middle age and above. Actually, you can't really call me middle age, because if right now my age were middle age, that would mean that I would live by far to be the oldest person who ever lived, by far. This is E-Person Monday. This is when I get a chance to look back over the many, many E-Persons that come in. Some of them come in from the TV show, Living Right with Dr. Ray, now airing season 13. I look back on those early shows thinking, who's the kid? Who's the kid doing that show? And a lot of folks... A lot of folks write from that, and a lot from the radio here. And I do what I can to, at some level, answer each one. However, not in the way that oftentimes people want. I may say, can you please call the show? I can ask some questions. I may say, I'd say about 15% of them are somebody asking for a referral to someone in their area that they can trust. So there are certain websites I refer them to. Some of them are to comment on something that came up. Fortunately, I don't get the nastier emails. I may get one nasty one every month or two, something like that. They usually send them on to EWTN. That's where the nasty ones go. So, we will proceed onward to those e-persons momentarily here. My second book was called Back to the Family. I authored it through a local Children's Hospital of Akron, Ohio, to a dear friend of mine who was the vice president of marketing. He had the idea to get National State Teachers of the Year in all 50 states to nominate very admirable families. People that they had come across that they say just represent some of the best stuff of family life. Now, not best in the way of prodigies or exceptional talents, but virtue, morality, responsibility, maturity, those characteristics. One of the things we did is we interviewed the parents about their own childhood. What was their childhood like? With the anticipation being that they had good childhoods. That if you're going to be a model parent, like a teacher believed, then you probably grew up in a pretty stable home yourself. In much of sociology or psychology's perspective, at least as presented through the popular media, if you had a bad childhood, you're going to have pretty much a bad adulthood. You may look okay, but there's percolating things underneath it all, and one day you're just going to up and torch four garages in the neighborhood, and people are going to say, she was such a nice lady, such a quiet lady. So this notion that you're kind of bound by the kind of childhood you had, and if it was ugly, you're going to struggle. Not only as an adult, but as a parent. Now, there is truth to that, of course. However, one of the unexpected findings of this book, Back to the Family, was that I'd say about 20 to 25% of these parents had nasty childhoods. Chaotic, ugly, abusive, and they got into some nitty-gritty. One fella talked about how his dad used to go to the bars and leave him in the car for hours at a time. And he was a little kid as he went inside and drunk it up. And others talked about the violence that they grew up with and they saw. So how did they explain the fact that they went on to become parents that were nonpareils, good examples of what parents should be? One fellow put it well. He was one of the more insightful young adults that we interviewed. He was a child of one of the families, but he was among the oldest. He said, "My mother had no affection growing up. My mother is the most affectionate person I know." And I asked, "How did you account for that?" He said, "She taught herself to be affectionate." Had another mother talk about how when she grew up with some of the ugliness, that she became very determined that if she ever became a mother, she's not going to do that. I titled one of the chapters Reverse Resolve. And that is that a number of these families said, "I would never want to do to my children, if I am fortunate enough to have children, what happened to me." And they became determined to be better parents than anything they had seen. Kind of goes against the narrative, does it not? The psychological narrative that you're bound by the way you were raised and what you missed, what you were robbed of growing up, when in fact a healthy minority of these parents said that made me more determined, more resolved to be a very different kind of parent. Now, there's something I must settle. Oftentimes, parents will come to me and they've been very permissive. And the reason they've been permissive is because they said they grew up in a home that was heavily strict, heavily autocratic, heavily my way or the highway punk. And they said, I know what that did to me. I know what I felt like. And I was going to make sure I wasn't going to do that to my kids. So what they did is they went in the other direction and became very permissive, or they became, let's all reason together, or they became too loose in their parenting because they simply didn't even want to come close to what they saw in their own upbringing. That's not what these parents were. They were a very healthy combination of love and discipline. They were not lax parents. They were not parents who were compensating for the way they were raised by going in the other direction. It made them much more loving in their report. But at the same time, they also recognized that they needed to have authority, and that authority was part of their love. So I think one way to misinterpret this would be, okay, I had an ugly childhood. I'm going to make sure that my child has a wonderful childhood. And part of that wonderful childhood is I'm really not going to be much of a disciplinarian because I don't want to frustrate him and I don't want to disappoint him and I don't want him to dislike me. That's not the mindset. If it was, how could so many of these parents be nominated by teachers as having some of the best kids these teachers had ever seen? You don't get that very often when you're a lax, permissive parent. It starts to show up over time. Unless you're fortunate enough just to have an incredibly temperamentally easygoing kid who somehow is raising herself or himself, reverse resolve. It's a testament to the resiliency of the human spirit. I'm Dr. Ray.
We'll return after these messages.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You thinking about homeschooling? Seton Homeschooling, 40 years of experience, 17,000 current students, pre-K through high school. They provide the books, the lesson plan, the counselors, the grading services, the tests. That's right, pretty much everything. My wife and I use Seton, some of our children. Tell you this, two of them got perfect ACT scores in verbal. And overall, the Seton students scored more than 100 points above average on the SAT. Over 30% higher on English and reading on the ACT. It's a rigorous program. You want to give the very best to your kids? Trust me on this one. Go with Seton. It is a beautifully rigorous academic program. Go to setonhome.org. That is setonhome.org.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi. Give me a little psychological booster shot. Raising your IQ so that you can not only be tough on Wheel of Fortune, but you can answer some of those questions on Jeopardy. Did you ever wonder that? You ever say to yourself, how did he know that? How did he know that river in Siberia? How do they do this? Well, makes me feel pretty intellectually intimidated. My daughter told me, quote, I love you conditionally and transitionally. What does she mean? Well, I can make a pretty good guess on conditionally, which is as long as you act in ways that I approve of or in ways that I find acceptable, okay, I will love you. Transitionally, me, I don't know, but typically that means, it means temporarily. In other words, it can shift. Getting a little insight into this as the mom goes on a little bit further. I asked her what I did wrong that she doesn't call me or come and see me. I told her I feel she doesn't love me. Okay, so she was probably responding to that. I feel you don't love me. And she said, instead of saying, yes, I do, she's saying, I love you conditionally and transitionally, which to me sounds like just a bunch of shallow qualification, which means, yeah, you're my mom, so I still love you, but I don't love you in any way that's going to be with any depth to it or tolerance. She didn't answer. And she got angry at me and didn't want to discuss it. I offered to go to counseling with her, and she said it was a little too late for that. And she told me I reaped what I sowed. Now, I can't know, obviously, the details and the dynamics of this mother-daughter relationship. There's no way. I can comment on the idea that it's a very common phenomenon now that these adult children blame their parents. That's very, very common. Whether it's our over-psychologized society and the kids look back when they're a little older and in fact they say, you just were so psychologically inappropriate with me, I realize that now. And there's no shortage of therapists out there telling these young adults, yeah, you really had a toxic environment growing up. You know, you got to put some distance there for your own well-being, your own emotional stability. Let's see. I had knee replacement, and this is the writer again, in August. My daughter never came over, never brought me anything or offered to help in any way. That's no surprise. See, okay, here's a comment I want to make about something like that. When we have a weak relationship with somebody, and then there's an event that we think, well, that should make them come a little closer to me. After all, I'm sick, or I'm in the hospital, or I've had a tragedy, or I'm hurting in some way. Okay, now they'll come around. And then you get shocked because they don't. Which doesn't surprise me, because if in fact they're going to tell you that I don't really like who you are, then when you get in a pickle of some type, there's a good chance they're not going to come closer to you. And that's what happened here. She said she didn't do any of these things. And there's a part of me that says, does that surprise you? She's already said, Mom, I love you conditionally. In other words, I can barely tolerate you. That's kind of what it sounds like to me. But I don't know. My son helped me. My daughter and I always fought on everything. Well, there you have an answer. Now, I don't know what those fights were about. I can't know. I can't say where the blame is or isn't. That's not possible. But if you fought on everything, that means you had a rough relationship. If you say, well, she was very difficult to raise, okay, that doesn't mean as a parent, because a kid is difficult to raise, you had to fight with her. I feel bad because I yelled too much and disciplined too hard. You know, my guess would be, when parents say they discipline too hard, my guess would be that they're not disciplined anywhere near too hard. They're disciplining too loud, or too mean, or too emotional. Discipline itself is not mean. Discipline itself is love. But it's the words and the emotion and the arguing, all of the clutter wrapped around the discipline that makes it seem like, yeah, it was too hard. My husband died when my children were very small and my daughter was close to her dad. She was 17 when he died, and it was very hard for her and the kids. She said, Mom says, I feel it was my fault for being too strict. You know, I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean you have standards? It's hard to be too strict when you have standards. You can be too harsh. I always tell that to parents. Can you be too strict? No, you can be too harsh. You can be too mean. You can fight too much. You can argue too much. You can nag too much. Yeah, you can do all of that, but that's not too strict. Matter of fact, that's kind of weak. So it sounds like what Mom is saying here is, I got frustrated. I was overloaded. And this kid was kind of tough. And we butted heads. And so when I look back on all that, I feel guilty because now she doesn't want to have anything to do with me. Over the holidays, she came. She was polite. But I know it was just because she wanted to see her siblings, not to see me. When you have a situation like this, you're in a situation that you're forced to do damage control. If you want to begin to heal the rift and make the love not so conditional or transitional, to use the daughter's words, you go to her, you say, I'm sorry, I have a lot of regrets over things I said, over decisions I made. I just want to apologize so much for all of them. And I will commit to you that I'm going to be very easy to get along with. Now, this daughter's an adult now, so really, mom doesn't have to worry about disciplining her. He doesn't have to worry about guiding her. Doesn't have to worry about any of that. All she's got to do is just be a more pleasant person to get along with. And you go and you apologize. Now, does that mean the daughter's going to say, "Why, mother, thank you so much. I was just waiting for that." No, probably not. Probably not. Probably, as the daughter says, a little too late. Okay, but at least you have the peace of knowing I did that. I went and I said, for things that I said or for ways that I acted, I got to tell you, looking back on it, I was feeling overwhelmed and I'm just so sorry. And I want you to know that I'm going to do everything in my power to be easy to get along with. That's probably all you can do. I've asked my daughter to forgive me, and she doesn't answer. Well, that's interesting, because see, I didn't know that was coming. As I said before, I choose these particular e-persons, and then I don't remember where they went in all of that. So, that's why I've offered to go to counseling, she says. My daughter feels that I love her siblings more than she, and she said, I just think I love her. I'm 72 and my daughter is 50. I want to heal this situation while I'm still on this earth. At some point, after you've done all you can do, you have to accept that you can't make a person forgive you. You can't make them look at you with more tolerance. You can't do it. And if you say, it's my fault, I did so many things wrong, well, welcome to the rest of us. Because you're not Christ, and you didn't act sinlessly. You did what you thought, and you acted out of frustration sometimes, and you acted out of hurt. You did it. That doesn't mean you're a horrible, terrible, awful, evil mother. It simply means you're a human mother. And some kids are just not going to find it in their heart to forgive you. Now, she says nothing about where this daughter is regarding her religion, but my guess would be, far more often than not, they've abandoned religion. Because religion's the one thing that says you got to forgive. If you ditch religion, there's no reason to forgive. Why should I? I'm upset at you. I've always been upset at you. We got an ugly history. Why should I want to be around you? There's no motive to forgive if you're not a Christian. Why?
Well, Dr. A, forgiveness is good for anybody, no matter who you are. That's true, it is. But most people are not going to think that way. They're not going to say, well, you know, I don't believe in Christ, I don't believe in God, but I think I'm going to forgive anyway because it'll be healthy for me. No. They'll just simply say, I don't like you, I don't want to forgive you, and I want to stay away from you. So I guess, Mom, what I'm saying to you, my prayer for you is not so much that you and your daughter reconcile. My prayer is that you find peace, that you look at this situation and say, I'm tired of feeling guilty. I'm tired of scouring my past. I'm tired of trying to figure out how to make it all right. I'm exhausted. I'm 72 years old. I want to be able to live settled about all this. Because if the daughter's basically saying, you played favorites, you like the other kids better, and that always, I don't say it always, that happens a lot when you have a difficult kid and the other kids are easier to relate to, the difficult kid says, you just treated them so much better than you treated me. Well, yeah, of course. You were tougher to deal with. They weren't. But the difficult person's not going to understand that.
Well, When we refer to our Father who art in heaven, are we talking to a God who is far removed from us? On the contrary, says the Catholic Catechism, we are talking to a Father who is close to humble and contrite hearts. We assert that God is in the hearts of the just, as he is in his holy temple. He is in heaven, his dwelling place. The Father's house is our homeland. Sin has exiled us, but conversion of heart enables us to return to the Father, to heaven. Christians are in the flesh, but they do not live according to the flesh. They spend their lives on earth, but are citizens of heaven. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
You know, maybe we need to ask ourselves, do we really know Jesus? Maybe another way to ask that would be, how familiar are you with the Gospels? When I was living in D.C., I was on the plane taking a late flight home, sitting next to a young girl. She was probably 16, 17. I had my collar on, and we got talking, and she said, somehow in the course of the conversation, she acknowledged that she was running away from home and was in the midst of an awful lot of difficulties that were going on. Her story seemed to be remarkably akin to the story of the prodigal son, which we just heard this past Sunday at Mass, huh? And so I started to speak a little bit about that with her. And I said, you sound a little bit like the younger son in the story of the prodigal son. And she looked at me like I was from Mars. And I said, are you not familiar with the story of the prodigal son? And she says, no, never heard it. And I just looked at her and I says, oh my goodness, are you in for a wonderful evening?
Thank you for joining me here on the E-Person Monday. My producer man today is Eric Dumont. He is often my call screamer when we take your calls. Hi, Dr. Ray. She says, hi, Dr. Ray and others. A lot of people think that. I will get some contact on the website, and they'll say, would you please direct this message to Dr. Ray? And I write back, okay, I will. I have two boys that are twins. They were born in 2019, just before the pandemic. They've lived a rather sheltered life for multiple reasons. Now, of course, well, the pandemic kind of shut everybody down. They now get very anxious in large gatherings or new situations. Yeah, the word for that is social anxiety. We're very creative. We shrink types. The latest situation is a new one that we knew would be difficult. We brought them to swimming lessons. I just got back from their first lesson, very frustrated and unsure of what to do about the problem. We've prepared for this by taking them swimming at the same pool. They were fine because I was with them. They love the water. They love swimming. They also watch their older siblings swim for the past year. Okay, good enough. Successive approximation is the fancy word for that. Bit by bit, you introduce the situation and you reinforce it. However, today, with all the other kids around, they would not sit down or even dangle their toes in the water. She says they were terrified. Now, that's a very strong word. Okay, I have to know where they fall on the continuum of this, because that would really make a difference on how much you try to move on ahead with this. I've had them go into a corner in the past, telling them they can come out when they're ready, and that has worked. Oh, okay. Some people would say, well, you don't do that. You don't set up a consequence because the kids have some kind of anxiety, but sometimes it's hard to sort out how much is anxiety and how much is resistance. This time, however, this is pretty slick of those boys. They figured out that they didn't have to face their fears if they just stayed in the corner. I'm not sure where to go from here. Aha! Mom, they outsmarted you. I can join the teacher in the water to ease into things, but this is a crutch that needs to be removed. Yeah, but you can remove it in time. I think you're on the right track. I think you're just sort of showing them, hey, this is cool. This is fine. What I would do is I'd say, okay, well, I'll tell you what. You don't have to swim, but you can just sit on these chairs and watch me swim and maybe your siblings swim, and we're just going to have a heck of a good time. And as they watch this, my guess would be that one of them will slowly decide to come around. Okay. I can't ask the teacher to deal with two crying boys while I leave the room and hope the boys face their fears. Well, yeah, probably not. She doesn't want to deal with that. She's trying to teach the other kids to swim. So what I would do, as I said, set up a couple chairs, and they can sit and watch. They don't have to. You don't have to swim at all. I'm not going to force it on you. They are only four. Not going to force it on you. But I'll tell you what, I'm gonna go in, and I'm going to have your siblings go in, and I'm going to play with your siblings and have a great time right in front of you. And I'm not going to turn and say, do you want to come in now? What do you think? Is it good? No. I'm not going to persuade and nudge. I'm just going to have the best old time I can have. And then, then I'm going to, on the way home, maybe drive through McDonald's and get a sundae for the older sibling and say, man, you burned up a lot of energy when you were swimming. That's a lot, so you need to get something to eat here. We're going to get you a sundae. And then the boys might say, well, I want one. Well, honey, I was going to get you one, but you didn't burn up any energy. You didn't go swimming. That's what I would do. She says, wondering if you have any advice, Dr. Ray. My goal for next week will be to have them sit on the pool deck with toes in the water to watch the lesson. Yeah, that's a good strategy. But even if they won't put their toes in the water, you can just have them sit nearby. I like it. This is dad. This was dad. I assumed this was a mom, but this is a dad. All right. Do you ever wonder how they teach Shamu and all these animals to do what looks to be very intelligent tricks? As I said, the word is successive approximation. What you do is you divide up the ultimate behavior that you want into smaller steps. And with each step that is successfully completed, you reward. You notice when you used to go to SeaWorld or any of those places, they always gave the fish or the mammal, I think the whales are mammals, right? At the end of their performance or even in certain parts of their performance. That's how they train people like dogs like Lassie. How'd they get Lassie to do all those things? Was Lassie just that smart? No. They successively approximated it. It's a standard behavior therapy kind of technique, and you can even use it as what's happening here with mom is or dad. They're using it to inch the kids toward swimming. The other factor could be that maybe the COVID isolation was part of it. And maybe this is just who they are. My little granddaughter was kind of like that for maybe when she was three and a half, four. She was a little shy to the point of resistance in new situations. Well, she's five and a half now, and that's pretty much gone. So it was part of her preschool immaturity. And I hesitate to call it immaturity because she's a little kid, part of preschool little kid. And as she got a little older, she found out, oh, these situations are not so threatening. And she lived through them, which is a good lesson for us grown-ups, because much that we avoid out of anxiety, we convince ourselves are threatening and that they can hurt us. And in fact, none of that is true. And sometimes you find that when you are forced to confront a situation that you would rather avoid because of whatever anxiety it causes you, you find that it wasn't as bad as you thought. And you, I don't want to say you endured it. I'm going to say that you sort of floated through it. And you find out that the anxiety, the awful fear was in your head, because it didn't show up in reality. I have a interesting scenario I'll share with you about that on the other side of the break. This is E-Person Monday. The program here is The Doctor Is In. I appreciate those of you who follow me on Facebook and the YouTube channel, and now my son has managed to start me on Instagram. I don't know any about that stuff, Snapface, Instaface, I don't know. But anyway, he's got me on there, so hopefully providing some helpful stuff that you can use or reject however you wish. And the website's drray.com, and all 19 books are there. So thank you for keeping me company.
Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
That idea of suffering is one of the reasons many people either turn away from God or they ignore faith altogether, because they cannot comprehend or wrap their heads around suffering and all the suffering in the world. This is an issue for you, and it's an issue for all of us from time to time when we go through rough situations, to say, Lord, what do you want me to learn about suffering? Ask the Lord to help you understand the meaning of suffering. God doesn't waste his time with anything. Whatever you go through, he will use if you allow him to use it. And you look at the greatest evil, right? The killing of God, Jesus, the Son of God, on the cross. And what came out of that? Our salvation.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
Living the Beatitudes with Father Bjorn.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. What does this strange beatitude mean? Well, Father Victor Feltz points out that George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life embodies this beatitude. He has to sacrifice his bucket list items and his dreams in order to save the building and loan company of Bedford Falls. But by the end of the movie, he realizes that he's truly the richest man in town. The Beatitudes challenge our understanding of happiness both as individuals and as a society. They're paradoxical and they upend our priorities. We don't need anyone to tell us that good fortune, money, and success do often make us happy. But we wouldn't have thought that the road to riches in God's kingdom is paved with meekness. It doesn't mean denying your gifts, but it does challenge us to allow others to have the spotlight and to approach them with gentleness. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
For more about the Beatitudes, visit EWTNRC.com.
Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. E-Person Monday. My producer man today is Eric Dumont, who is normally my call screamer man. Hi, Dr. Ray. I have a question about my duty as a Catholic to extended family members. Well, I could wrestle with that word duty, yeah. My maternal grandfather has not been part of my life since I was a small child at age 11 or so. I only saw him a handful of times. He was not physically abusive to my mother, that would be her dad, but he is a difficult person and their relationship was always poor, especially after he and my grandmother divorced. She chose to live with my grandmother. I mean, she's saying her mother chose to live with the writer's grandmother, which effectively severed the relationship, right? No relationship with grandpa. They have limited contact now. Periodic testing. I wouldn't know this man if I passed him on the street. I couldn't pick him out of a lineup. Nice image. Now, my aunt is in contact with him. She was always his favorite, though he is difficult with her too. When I say difficult, Dr. A, I mean he tells outrageous lies of self aggrandizement. We're going to find out what that means here in a second. Usually, he makes things up to top whatever story someone else is telling. All right, well, who knows the wiring of his personality here. His temper flares quickly and unpredictably, as he will suddenly become angry and explosive for no reason. Woo! Well, if you're describing somebody that's not only difficult but quite unpredictable. My aunt, this is the one that he likes, reached out to my mother asking to send my phone number to him, my grandfather. My mother does not want me to have contact with him. I don't want contact with him. We did speak briefly the last time he reached out. My number has been since changed. Shortly after the birth of my first child, and he kept me on the phone for an hour telling outrageous lies. For instance, he was the chief of homicide during a particular serial killer investigation in a major U.S. city. Now, if he believes this, this is potentially a sign of a delusion, which means he's not thinking in his right mind. I can't diagnose that from here. I don't know why he's saying these things. He may just be lying to fluff himself up in somebody else's eyes. But if he believes it, that takes it into another realm of mental disorder. He eventually began saying terrible things about my mother. Now, this was their last conversation, at which point I ended the conversation. He texted periodically wanting to visit me and my husband and son, which I deflected. I was really disturbed by this sudden outpouring of venom toward my mother, in other words, his daughter, who was not the topic of conversation, and I didn't want to talk to him again. Okay, this may answer my question. Again, as I always said, I don't remember where the e-person goes, and sometimes I make comments and read between the lines before I get to more details in the e-person, and here could be one. My grandfather has dementia. Okay, that may be a reflection of the delusions that he was telling. Delusions are not uncommonly part of dementia. She says, I understand that it's my duty as a Catholic to honor my elders. Well, that's true, but that doesn't mean you have to put yourself in scary, dangerous situations. I texted him explaining that I'm pregnant with baby number two and have been sick, and I am not up for a phone call right now, but we will remember him in our family rosaries. That's nice. If he texts me back, I am okay with having a small talk conversation as long as my mom does not come up. Do you think it's morally acceptable to keep things at this level with my grandfather? Well, I'm not one to comment. I'm not a theologian. But I would say that it's perfectly understandable that you'd want to keep him at a distance, especially now that he is even complicating his interactions with you by dementia. Is it acceptable to keep things at this level, or do I need to pursue more of a relationship to avoid breaking the commandment? No, honoring your elders doesn't mean you have to put yourself in a situation that is unpredictable, hostile, and very hard to manage. Doesn't mean that. You are praying for him. That's quite an honor there. You're lifting him up in a rosary. And you're even having small talk. I would suggest this, though. The instant that any of those small conversations start to go sideways, and that could be because of the dementia, it could be because of hostility, it could be because he just wants to rail against your mother. The instant that happens, I gotta go now. Thanks for calling. Bye. Absolutely. That's not dishonoring. That's simply pulling out of a very ugly situation. Honoring does not mean you have to put yourself in a situation that is emotionally very risky. Now, you're talking to a guy who thinks that many of us can do a lot better dealing with difficult people. But there does come a point where in this situation, you hadn't seen him for years and years and years. He was not part of your life. So for whatever his reason to come back in, and maybe he's struggling with aging now, and somehow, some way he feels isolated, I don't know what his motive is to try to get back in your good graces. But it appears, at least from what you're describing, that he can't stay on an even keel. And I think you're perfectly appropriate to keep him at arm's distance while you still pray for him or you have the tiniest of small talks with him. I'm Dr. Ray.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Have you ever been so grief-stricken and so heartsick that you can't see God? You can't see God in the tragedy. You can't see God in that cross. You can't see God in that sin. Why? You're enveloped in that grief. You're enveloped in fear. And God is out the window. You don't see Him standing right next to you.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Very nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, co-production of Ave Maria Radio Communications in Ann Arbor, Michigan, as well as EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Let's see what we got here. I tried calling your radio show, but the call kept getting dropped. I have three kids. My two girls get 33% of my mother's inheritance. My son gets 33%. He's listed as the executor. My mom passed away a year ago, and I have recently found out she left me out of her will. She didn't tell me because I was successful and comfortable. How'd you find that out? How did you find out her motive? If she didn't tell you that she left you out of the will, how do you know it was because you were successful and comfortable? Maybe a sibling told you that, or someone that mom confided in and told you she thinks you didn't need the money. Okay. And then he says, I don't need the money. But I felt slighted for doing the right things. If you're saying I was successful monetarily, And that was a result of being responsible, making good decisions, being conscientious. And those are good things in life. And I didn't get rewarded from my mom monetarily because of that. I know this is easy for me to say. I wouldn't take that personally. She may just view it as, because she left the inheritance to your kids. And I know a lot of grandparents who do that. They kind of skip over the adult generation because they say the adult generation is pretty much set up. So given that, I wouldn't feel bad about that. I would view it as maybe she's paying you a compliment that in fact you don't need this. Alrighty, I was going to talk about something that I experienced, and I will tell you in all candor, I forgot what it was. That's what happens when you take a 2-minute break. So I wanted to share with you a situation. I was reading that previous email. Yeah, I will come back to it. I'll get it. Let's see what else we got here. Ann. My mother passed away 2 weeks ago. She disinherited me and my older brother. We refused to enable her to control my father in his later years. I don't know exactly what that translates into. I'm sure that mom didn't agree with however they managed their refusal, however that manifested itself. My parents are interesting. She divorced him, remarried him, and later he divorced her. We're an explosive couple. I could write books. My younger brother inherited everything, I assume. I have no regrets. It doesn't actually surprise you, does it, that she disinherited you? Because if you're looking at that kind of ongoing turbulence in their marriage and their existence, and somehow, some way, you were part of that, and she saw you as taking the wrong side, and she was the remaining parent, because I'm going to read between the lines and assume that your dad passed away before she did, so then she, by law, because she's now remarried, I guess, it says here later he divorced her, so I don't know exactly how that all works out, but apparently she had the inheritance, at least what part was hers, and she just thought, no, you were not my allies when you should have been my allies. And, of course, I don't know exactly what you did or didn't do that made her think that. Maybe you didn't do anything that made her think that. Maybe you were just taking the high road and she didn't like that. I have no idea. My younger brother inherited everything, I assume, so apparently he hasn't told you that. I will say this, though. I've seen an awful lot of families fracture after the last remaining parent passes away and the inheritance is not split like the siblings think it should have been, or somebody got something that they think they didn't deserve. I just see so much of that. I've had people that I know not talking to their siblings for years because there was some glitch in the inheritance, or you got this and I didn't get that, and mom left me out, or mom left you out, or you got left out, so therefore you think I should give you half anyway. That's very common, by the way, which is I didn't get my fair share, so you got more than I did, so you need to make it even, and if you don't, I'm going to be upset. That's really sad. I mean, it kind of brings out the ugliness. And it speaks a little bit to the fact that the parents were the glue, and once the glue sort of dissolved, then the siblings who are now 50, 55, 60 years old, whatever, just go their separate ways because the glue was holding them together at least marginally. I see that a lot. I know my sister, when my mom passed away, my sister gave a beautiful, beautiful memory of her after the Mass. And I got up and I couldn't top that. And I said, you know, families fight. Families fight after the last surviving parent passes on. And I said, we don't do that. Me and my three siblings, we're not fighting over this. They can have whatever they want. It doesn't matter to me. The only thing I really want is my mother's coupon book. I mean, she lived by coupons. Mom didn't buy anything without a coupon. If she didn't have a coupon for it and double coupon days, she didn't go. And I just said, I want my mom's coupon book valued at approximately $1.2 million. That's all. That's all. Just a coupon book. You can have the car. I'll take the coupon book. I paid for the funeral for $16. Mom had a coupon. Thanks for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi, Monday through Friday. I appreciate the company so very, very much. Walk with God all the way to being with Him forever.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.